Hi, Dave. Eric. Conscious Living on Empower Radio. Thanks for listening. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your interest. And hopefully today we've got a great cast, me and my guest, who's stellar. Angela Joyner is best known maybe for breaking the UFO sighting story in Stephenville, Texas, and that got her an international awareness, an international footnote. And I saw that she was going to be doing an event this year, the UFO Women's Symposium, coming up in Texas. It's actually the place where they have these wonderful dinosaur footprints, the tracks of dinosaurs in Glen Rose. There's a park there that's incredible. Anyway, so when I saw that, I thought, okay, this is the time to get back in the swing of things and really hit the UFO thing hard. And Angela has been on, if you've seen some of the shows, you know, you already know who she is, but she was on James Fox's I Know What I Saw on the History Channel. She's also done some, she was with Larry King doing an interview there. She's also, I think, made a real, you know, good track record. And Angela, I really appreciate you taking the time for this and adding your voice. I know that you've talked with you had a talk show that you were hosting for a while. You've talked with a lot of people like Leslie Kane and James Fox and Stan Romanek, Paula Harris, there's a laundry list of names that people might recognize if they're familiar with this topic. So today I want to give you a chance to make a plug for your appearance and share a little bit about how this has changed your life.
Hi, Wendy. Thanks for having me on. Even before I will speak for the Women's UFO Symposium in Glen Rose, Texas, I will be speaking in San Antonio on March the 3rd for Texas MUFON. And the keynote speaker at that time is Travis Walton. So I'm really looking forward to that one. I've interviewed Travis myself and I've emailed with him and that sort of thing, but I've never met him in person. And for those that are listening that might not know, Travis's story is what the movie Fire in the Sky is based on. And that's March the 3rd. Then I will be speaking in Glen Rose, Texas, which is just a stone's throw from Stephenville. It's actually about an hour's drive. And that will be May 18th, 19th, and 20th. I will speak on the 19th about 3 o'clock. And afterwards, I will lead a panel of the main witnesses at about 4 o'clock, and that will include Robert Powell, and he is the co-author of the Stephenville Radar Report, Ricky Sorrells, who was a witness in mid-December 2007, and Constable Leroy Gayton, who is one of the witnesses for the January the 8th, 2008 mass sighting, and then Steve Allen, who originally reported to me at the Stephenville Empire Tribune. So I'm really looking forward to that. And as you know, Paula Harris is actually putting that conference together. So there is an early bird registration fee of $75. And we're hoping, you know, to get as many people in as possible through StarWorksUSA.com. You can go there to register.
Okay. You can also follow it on Facebook too. So if you're interested in doing that, you can link to me or Angela on Facebook and we can point you in the right direction. But, real quickly, Travis Walton, I thought I remembered something about and was it a double? He was with somebody else and they were both picked up or, abducted. Was that the one I'm thinking of or is that a different one?
No, Travis Walton was actually, had been out in the forest, you know, his job was in logging, and there were about six of them in a truck, and they were actually off work, heading back to town, and they saw something and stopped to look at it, and Travis got out of the vehicle, walked towards it, and it hit him with some sort of a blue light. And at that time, of course, the others that were in the truck with him just really kind of freaked out. They thought he was dead. It just knocked him to the ground. He didn't show up again for 5 days. A couple of the guys felt bad about leaving him, and they had gone back out there, and he was not out there. he has an incredible story, probably one of the best documented abduction stories ever. And of course, they based the movie Fire in the Sky from his story. And Travis has told me that it was fairly accurate until the time showing him on the ship. And then it was a lot different. The movie's a lot different from what his actual experience was. But it was in Snowflake, Arizona, I believe, is where it occurred.
Okay. Yeah. And what I remember was that some of these things, the media or whoever does the movies tends to make them a little bit over dramatic. And does that apply to his in terms of the ET connection, making that what I have read is once the contact continues, it seems to be less frightening. And if that can be, you know, applied to it, Travis not quite as overblown.
Travis has never admitted that the contact has continued, but if I were him, I wouldn't admit that either, because he was really raked over the coals by the media. All of them passed lie detector tests, except for one. And then it was learned later that the one that didn't pass had some trouble going on with the law. Like either there was a warrant out for his arrest, something like that. I'm not certain. My memory is kind of failing me there. But they felt like that's the reason he failed, is his nervousness due to this whatever law enforcement problem he had. Now, you're right. On movies, they do, you know, lots of times they're over dramatic. I can't really say that in this case, simply because his story is so dramatic and I feel it's truthful. You know, he was let go, or whatever, he brought back to earth, whatever you want to call it. And he was face down on the pavement in a neighboring town and had called his brother, or it might have been his brother-in-law. And they didn't really even believe it was him. And then he said something that they realized it was him. And when they went to get him, he had this beard growth that was about 5 days old. And of course, he didn't know he had been gone that long. And that was one of the things they were trying to explain to him, is, you know, you've been gone 5 days. Where have you been? Everybody's been looking for you. And he just couldn't believe he'd been gone that long. And that's one of the things they said, well, look at your beard. Your beard has grown out. And he was just amazed. And then, you know, the story goes on from there. But it's very, quite a compelling story. And it occurred in the 70s. And when I had my radio show, The Joyner Report, I interviewed him. And I've talked to him on the phone personally a couple of times. And then we've emailed back and forth. And so on March 3rd in San Antonio, I'm really looking forward to meeting him in person for the first time.
Okay. Now, the thing I like about you and what got my attention was when I saw the Stephenville, Texas thing, and I saw your name, it was like, oh my gosh, there's a journalist. There's somebody who's there, who's local, who's on the case, where a lot of times these things happen. And it's either, you know, poo-pooed or just laughed off. And people don't take it seriously. That's my frustration. But with you being right there and it being accessible, what is your experience? And can you kind of play it out for people who aren't familiar with how you got involved?
All right. I was a staff writer for the Empire Tribune, and I received a phone call from Steve Allen. He lives in Glen Rose, and while we were talking, you know, he told me that he had been a pilot for more than 30 years, and he had seen something in the sky it was unbelievably large, something that he just couldn't understand, and he had three other people with him. And gave me all of their numbers, and they were willing also to go on the record. So I talked to all of those people. Steve told me that he kept his plane at our local airport in Stephenville. So I also called there just to kind of check him out and see what kind of a guy he was. And the manager at the airport said, oh my gosh, he's called you too. He called us early this morning and we've been trying to help him figure out what it could have been. They had made some phone calls to people they knew that were air traffic controllers or at the FAA, that sort of thing. And so it really got me interested. And I decided to go ahead and do the story. And the first story, you know, included Steve plus his three friends. And they were on a property just outside of Stephenville in a little community called Selden. And Steve asked me to include his phone number in that first story. And I said, are you sure you want to do that? He said, yes, this thing was so large. I know other people had to have seen it. And he was hoping that someone might have gotten a photo or a video. So, you know, what he saw was something really large. And at first it looked like it had four lights on each corner. And it came over them in Selden, headed towards Stephenville, looked like it stopped. And then they had gone inside the house to talk to the property owner's wife to tell her, you know, what they had seen. They were so freaked out. She had not been there. She was just coming home from work. So she didn't believe them. So the third person, who was the mailman, had just left. And they said, well, if you don't believe us, call Lance. His name was Lance Jones. So she did. And he said, yes, that's what happened. And get back outside because it's coming back. So then all three of them went out. And this time when it was coming back over them, it had two jets in pursuit. And at the time, Steve told me he wasn't sure what kind of jet. It was either an F-15 or an F-16, because the only way that you can tell the difference is in the tail, and he wasn't sure. And so when we put his phone number in that first story, that story ran on January the 10th. And he began receiving a lot of phone calls at his office, and I did too, at the newspaper. And people were telling me the story that you wrote about Steve Allen. I saw it too. Or they were asking, you know, do you know what it is yet? And some people were calling in wanting to know is this the reason we have the increased air traffic, the military traffic in the sky today? And I really wasn't aware of that. Of course, you know, I had been inside working, but when I went out for lunch, there was two Chinook helicopters that came over the newspaper, and they were really low, lower than what I was used to seeing. And I thought to myself, I wonder if this is what people are talking about. And the story just kept gaining momentum. From those contacts that day, that turned up the constable that probably a lot of your listeners have seen on television a lot. His name is Leroy Gayton, and he's an elected official, and he lives right outside of Dublin. And he had observed red flashing lights that took off at incredible speed with his young son. And you know, a few more witnesses that I wrote about. Then the story had gone national at that point, and it went international after Associated Press writer Angela Brown interviewed Ricky Sorrells. And I had talked to Ricky, but I hadn't done a story on him yet. But she went out to his property and did a little film with him that they put on the AP site. And when they did that, the story really took off. It was just incredible. It was unbelievable. We had all kinds of media trucks rolling in just constantly, and I was doing all kinds of interviews. The witnesses were doing all kinds of interviews. And it was about 8 days I believe it was January the 18th, that we were on Larry King Live talking about it. And CNN had already called me a couple of times to do just audio interviews in their newsroom. So this story really surprised me the way that it was picked up on. One of the things that other journalists told me, you know, that they liked was I reported as a straight news story. I didn't mention any little green men. There was nothing. I didn't put anything about flying saucers. And that gave them sort of a gateway to start writing about it themselves without having the tongue-in-cheek added to it.
Well, I think part of it is that when we're working in the media, because that's my background too, you're looking for sound bites, you're looking for credibility, you're looking for somebody who pretty much is neutral so that you can at least have, if you're doing a story, especially of this nature, one credible source. And sometimes the witnesses are themselves tainted because they may have had some kind of a bias or a need for publicity, something, you know, something that you can't see. So you're looking desperately for anybody there to validate this information. And with your background, you became the automatic go-to for somebody who had a neutral, objective, positive, right there on the fence position for this story. And I think that worked in a tremendous favor, you know, for you.
It may have. Of course, at the time I was writing it, myself, I was just thinking it would be an interesting story for our community because I thought maybe as a community we could get together and maybe figure out what it was, you know, what had happened. I just thought it would be interesting for the readership.
Well, I think part of it too, though, is that you're right there local. And if anybody knows who these people are, you do, or at least that would be something I would assume, that you can immediately on the spot validate, well, this person is legit. Does that make sense?
I was raised in Stephenville. Of course, like all young people, when I was 18 or 19, you know, I couldn't wait to get out of there. But when I was 32, I had gotten a divorce and I had a 2-year-old daughter, and so I moved back. So I was familiar with most of the people. I didn't know everybody that reported to me, of course, but like I had never met Steve Allen before. He actually lived in Glen Rose and had a business in Glen Rose. But usually if I didn't know somebody, I might know somebody that did. So it was just incredible how many people saw something, and it's still incredible how many did see something and still won't report it.
That that won't report thing, I am really not surprised, because when you look at some of the stuff that comes out and how really pervasive that message is, that if you say something, then something negative, if not now, may further down the line happen because you've tied yourself to this issue. And it's a real easy way to discredit people. Some people that, as I've been doing this, the result has been that they've lost jobs. They've lost their own personal way of, you know, making a living because they've been connected to this type of stuff. And when you see this stuff that came in the book that Leslie Kane wrote, you know, these guys had a whole lot to lose, and a lot of them just waited until they were out of that particular, you know, factory to come forward and say, this is what we know. It isn't what we think. It's what we know. It's what we've experienced. And Fife Symington, you know, making a big joke about the whole thing. And then what, 10 years after, finally confessing and saying, well, guess what? About that, let me add one more thing. I saw it, you know, those kinds of things. And the other thing that some people say, that once they have gone public with it, they wish they hadn't because of what it did to their lives and to the people around them, because then everybody kind of comes out of the woodwork. Both sides are represented, people who want it validated and people want it discredited. So you get hit from all different angles. Have you experienced any of that yourself?
Well, I have seen, as far as other people or me?
You.
Okay. You probably know that I'm not at that particular newspaper anymore. And when you're in a small town, you don't have a lot of choices in journalism. So that's the only game in town. I gave my notice to that newspaper because it was a very strange situation for me. They had asked me to stop doing any stories that were UFO related or related to that main story. And I tried to do that, but like when I asked, what am I supposed to do about all of these emails? I mean, they had had to dump my emails twice because it was just so full. It got clogged up, I guess. And then I was still the media contact. I was still the witness contact. And I said, well, you know, after a day of trying not to do UFO stuff, I went in and asked the editor, what am I supposed to do? She said, just ignore them. And I said, well, what about these main witnesses? Because they were still being inundated with media requests, and they depended on me to sort of help them and guide them through that. And plus, everybody still wanted to know what it was. So I went back to my desk and I thought about it, and I thought, I can't do these witnesses that way. You know, it's just not right to say, oh, I'm the one that wrote the story, but I'm going to leave you I'm going to hang you out to dry here. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up writing a resignation letter, and I tried to take care of the UFO stuff either on my lunch hour or after hours, after I had finished for the day, by, you know, forwarding those emails to my home computer, using my phone, you know, when it on to for that subject, you know, when I wasn't being paid by the newspaper. And that didn't go over well at either. Robert Powell had he's the national research director for MUFON, and the editor had overheard me telling someone else in the newsroom that I was meeting him for dinner that night. She said, I thought you were dropping all this stuff. And I said, well, this is on my own time. You know, it was this sort of thing that was very stressful to me. And about a week into my 2 weeks notice, I came into work and they had taken my computer and had taken my Rolodex and some of my files that, you know, had to do with the UFO stuff, and called me into the publisher's office, and that's where my computer was and all of my things were. And, you know, they talked to me for about 2 hours and said, you know, that I wasn't doing them right by leaving. What was I going to do? Was I going to work for the Dallas Morning News? I had had a meeting with an interview for the Dallas Morning News. It had nothing to do with me having an application with them or them trying to hire me, you know. I couldn't have gone to Dallas if I wanted to. I had a 16-year-old daughter in high school, and the last thing I would have done was uproot her. And they wanted to know if I was going to write a book. I said, no, I'm not going to write a book. I don't know where you're getting all this. And it was a very uncomfortable meeting for me. As a matter of fact, I left in tears. They gave me a cardboard box and said, well, you know, just go. Get your stuff and go. So I did.
Having been down that path a few times, not necessarily for that reason. Usually it was a buyout situation where all of a sudden one company owns you and the former company is saying, by the way, here's your pink slip. I don't envy you being in that position. What I do think, though, that you experienced is a lot more common than people realize, that once this becomes part of your resume, part of your background, part of your, whether you want it or not, part of your interest, then there's a huge, I think, fear factor that comes along with that, where everybody else is very concerned about their own reputation and that you might somehow affect that. When we come back, I want to talk about what you're doing now and what you've learned from a lot of these people that you've interviewed, because you do have a very good guest list from your own show, and I'd like to find out more about that. When we come back, you're listening to Angela Joyner on Empower Radio. This is Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett.
In 1977, in Johannesburg, South Africa, an 8-year-old boy picked up the game of golf from his father. By the age of 9, he was already outplaying him. The odds of that same boy then making it to the US and European pro golf tours? 1 in 7 million. The odds of the Big Easy winning the Open Championship once and the US Open Championship twice? 1 in 780 million. The odds of this professional golfer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Ernie Els encourages you to learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
20 years ago, the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law. The act was a huge step forward for the 50 million people in this country living with a disability, and the culmination of years of effort by those who marched and spoke up and refused to be treated as second-class citizens. It helped renew the promise that here in America, we're defined not by our limitations, but by our potential. As we celebrate the 20th anniversary of this historic legislation, it's important to remember that we're still fulfilling that promise. We're still working to secure the rights guaranteed by the ADA, the right to live and work without limits, the right to equal justice under the law, and the right of every person in this country to reach for the American dream. We've come a long way since 1990, and I'm committed to making even more progress in the years ahead. Visit disability.gov to see how you can help.
Brought to you by the American Association of People with Disabilities and the Ad Council.
Play ball!
Now pitching, Dave Black.
Dave is about to catch his opponent off guard. Not with his nasty fastball. No, instead of a fastball, Dave will be hurling a tomato.
And the pitch.
Ooh. Using tomatoes as baseballs won't go over well with anyone. But if you're looking to hit the ball further and throw better, eating a healthy diet that includes fruits and vegetables is a home run. Packed with nutrients, they could help keep your body healthy and strong, giving you the energy you need to hit that grand slam. When you look at it this way, eating tomatoes is playing hardball against the competition. Run, throw, think, eat better. Can your food do that? Find out at smallstep.gov.
That's smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Hi there, I'm Wendy Garrett. This is Conscious Living on Empower Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you're having a great day, great time, wherever you are. I'm really, really excited that I finally got my guest, Angela Joyner, who is known worldwide for breaking the story, the UFO story in Stephenville, Texas. I've got her here in person to give us a rundown of what happened to her after breaking this story. And I guess, you know, you look at it, it's almost, what, 4 years to the date that this was, that you broke it?
That's right.
So that's an amazing, I think, synchronicity, that it's taken quite, you know, the way that it's gone, the many people who have now come to the public view, the forefront with this issue. You actually, I think, have done a huge service by giving people something to talk about and adding a level of credibility where they don't feel like they're a nutcase just because they've had a sighting, an experience, a connection. And at the same time, you had to kind of redirect your life by obviously talking about the job change before we went into the break. And what I want to find out, though, is how else, after you've talked to these other people about their stories, has that changed or in any way affected your view of this topic?
Well, I would have to say yes, because before this story happened, I was not into the UFO subject. If I had seen something on TV, I might watch it, think, that was interesting, and go right on with my life. I didn't pay attention to this sort of thing. I think I was like most of the public. I thought it was interesting, but I didn't spend any time researching or looking into it, and I didn't know, you know, who the who's who in ufology. Afterwards, I had so many people contact me. While I was still at the newspaper, Timothy Good kept emailing me and saying, if you will get my book, call my publisher or email my publisher, and he put the link there, it will help you understand a lot of what's going on. And I thought, who is Tim Good? And he wants me to get his book. I didn't know that he was very well known in the UK and the rest of the world for, you know, his work and his research. He was considered a very good researcher. One of his books, Above Top Secret, I think, was a bestseller. So from that point on, I have been interested, and I started getting invitations to speak at different places. The first place that I spoke was at the Ozark Conference in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. And one of the first people that came up to me was Timothy Good. Oh, I was so glad to see him. It was like I had a long lost friend there. I was like, oh no, you know, you won't believe all this. He said, I know exactly what has happened to you and how you feel. And I appreciated him so much. And then Grant Cameron was there. And for people that might not know who he is, he runs the Presidential UFO website. And he does all of his research on presidents and what they may or may not have known. He visits all of the like the National Archives and each president's library looking for UFO documents and that sort of thing. So I started meeting people that actually did do the research and was just amazed at the stories I was hearing and the things that had gone on and learning the history of ufology and how it was sort of all put together. And boy, it was like a baptism by fire. It's so much information out there that I totally was not aware of. So it did change my life. And, you know, besides not being a staff writer anymore at the newspaper, you know, which is always hard to lose your income. But I kept going to these conferences and speaking at different places. And I believe the next one was at the X conference near Washington, D.C. And they had a Saturday night banquet, and each speaker had a table with their name in the center of it on a little pedestal thing. And I started looking around the room, and at the table next to me was Dr. Bruce McAbee and astronaut Edgar Mitchell and Paul Hellyer, who was the former defense minister in Canada, just different people like that. I thought, could this many very intelligent people be that far out in left field? There really is something to this. It wasn't what I would have imagined if you had gone to a UFO conference with people. To me, it would have been my imagination, because I'd never attended one. It would have been, you know, people in Star Wars costumes and tinfoil hats. And it wasn't that at all. Just some of the people at my table were college professors. It was a very, very intelligent group in that room. And that sort of gave me pause. And I thought, you know, I'm going to really start looking into this, because there's something more to it.
Well, what I've noticed about it is that if you're anywhere near this topic, you really darn sure better build your resume first.
Well, it's known as a career killer, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, you know, there was one guy in town here, local in the Midwest, Mike Murphy, used to be our UFO guy. And people are, oh, they will, you know, listen to him because he's got all these crazy stories and all these crazy. He was just a crazy UFO guy. And I told somebody recently, I said, you know what? I'm going to be the Mike Murphy. Because for one thing, I wouldn't go near it earlier. I went on a deeper end and had this a huge metaphysical shift where I started experiencing things that other people can't see, but for me, they're reality. And that was like, well, if I'm going to go there, there's nothing that this UFO thing can do to me. Because I'm pretty much, you know, beyond the limb now, just hanging onto a leaf at the very end. Because that once I did that personal metaphysical shift of, I know what is real for me, then I really don't have a problem if other people don't experience my reality, because it just shifted me to be able to be a lot more confident and secure knowing that this stuff is out there, and no, everyone isn't going to see it. There may be a reason for that. I don't know. I just know that each of us has a different perspective, a different view, and a different awareness, but we are having some kind of connection or contact. And if we don't talk about it, we lose opportunities to figure out what similarities we all share with this information. And the more people with legit backgrounds in media or in broadcasting or in journalism, or as you go on up into the teaching professions and the with the people who are pilots and people who are very, very well versed into what type of technology we have that can do what we're seeing and what we don't have, then we start building a huge network, a library, some kind of arena where we can discuss these things and get a clue about what we are, I guess, shifting into. And I think the shift is a lot more about our opening up to the awareness that we are not alone. And it isn't just a spirit thing. It's an actual physical thing that we're having, whether it's a multidimensional or transdimensional or, you know, something about it that we really are going to be having to create a whole new type of science to determine or identify or describe or define. I don't know. But I know a lot of people are now saying, this is part of my reality. What next? And when they call the, you know, the local MUFON, like in Missouri, we had a huge, huge number of sightings from May to through the end of the year. And it isn't, it's overwhelming, the numbers that are now starting to happen. And you're saying, okay, there are going to be a number of them that are hoaxes. But it's the numbers that are legit that we want to find out more about. And I think that's the way Leslie Kane approached it. 5%, they had no way of accounting for. Well, that's what brings the mystery about. Why not investigate? If there are 5%, that's really a big number when you're talking about something that we are, that we're told confounds our pilots. That's, I don't think you want a 5%. I think you want zero.
Well, that's right. And it makes you wonder, if those 5% cannot be explained, and then why isn't it a national security issue? You know, I used to talk to Nick Pope quite a bit, and that was one of the things that we talked about, that it might not only be a national security issue, but it could also be an air traffic hazard.
Yeah. yeah.
You know, as the years go on, we get more and more planes in the sky. There's been a number of pilots that have reported near misses and seen things that they cannot explain. So why isn't it being investigated by law enforcement or the government, some branch of government, looking into it? You ought to be able to control what is in the skies. And at this point, it doesn't seem like there's any control.
Well, that's what it sounds like. And I think that's why they're really avoiding the topic like the plague, because the minute they have to come forward and say, we can't control it, then there's the, you know, the potential for the hysteria factor we haven't yet begun to imagine on a worldwide level of, oh no, now what, you know? And it's, to me, that's kind of a joke anyway. It's either here or it isn't. And you can't control everything. And one way or the other, we're going to come face to face with what else is out there. I don't know how our world and our life will shift when that happens, but it's beginning to kind of trickle in that this is on the horizon, and that eventually there will be some kind of uniform acknowledgement that we are not in charge. If in this particular area, that there's something that has abilities that we are not yet on par with. And when that day comes, wow, wow, that'll change the whole, it's like a paradigm shift. We'll be in an entirely new arena. And it makes the home shopping network seem like a really nice escape.
Well, if there is some sort of acknowledgement, you know, I'll really be surprised, because this has been going on 60 something years. And sometimes I feel like, you know, they're not any closer to a disclosure than they were when Kenneth Arnold first reported a flying saucer. And I think that was in the 40s. So I don't know how it would come about. Of course, it was I was encouraged, you know, when the UK released some of their, or began releasing all of their files in a systematic way. And I know some other countries have done the same. I would like to see the United States do that, but who knows, will they or won't they? We have these White House petitions now, and they really seem to go nowhere. So I don't know what it would take for there to be some sort of public acknowledgement, unless it's by the visitors.
Yeah, well, see, that's my thing. Is I think that what'll happen will be an after the fact, an admission that, okay, and this is what we have been doing about it. And in a way, I think that's a safe game, because until they really have a full understanding of what it is that they're dealing with, how do you go on record and say, in a leadership position, I don't know, and expect anybody then to follow you? That's a really tough leadership position to own. I don't know. Okay, fine. We're going to find somebody who does. And even when they give you a line of bull, you're more likely to follow the person who thinks they may know something than the one who blatantly and boldly and confidently says, you know, I don't know. That's one of our problems. we're willing to trust people who are full of it over the ones who are really honest and say, let's learn together on this one. Okay, you may know a few things that I could use in my arsenal, and the more we collaborate, the more power we're going to have as we build our arsenal of information and content. And I think that's what's happening behind the scenes, is that they're continuing to do whatever is necessary to figure out what's happening. And when you follow, you know, your story and say you noticed more air traffic of the accountable kind after the sightings, then that tells me something else is going on. It's just not public. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense to me. I guess it's just going to be a wait and see cat and mouse game to see how, you know, it all comes about. I know that, you know, there are people that believe if there was a public acknowledgement by government officials, that we would end up in total chaos, and there would be, you know, total breakdown of the churches, lines at the emergency rooms. I don't know if that would happen, you know.
I know. I think that's a really nice fear story to put out to make people, to frighten them into not saying anything and not asking for what they aren't prepared to deal with. You know, you don't want the truth, that kind of thing. You can't handle it. Yeah, that's a good story.
Yeah, I just don't really think that would happen long term. You know, it might happen the first couple of days, and then people will have to go back to doing just what they were doing, getting up, going to work, and making a living and taking the kids to soccer.
I agree. And I don't think they would know what else to do. It's like, well, I can't do anything about that, so I'm just going to go ahead and continue and see how it plays out. I think that's a much more realistic assessment of what the situation would produce, because we've already got Occupy, you know, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy, and they're busy.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going to be able to help us with this one. But that's my thought, is that if this is an announcement of some kind, then life really doesn't change except for in your head about whether they are here to hurt us or help us. And that hasn't been made public on any grand basis. There are people who've had encounters and contact, and there are different perspectives from them as well. You know, that they had a positive experience and others a negative experience. And it's just a matter of time before we get more information, I think, on a grander scale about what this means for us as a planet, as a species, as I think it's forcing us to become a lot more, I think, aware of the potential of what's going to happen when we do go out further into space and we do try to engage other, I don't know, cultures, other species, other, you know, consciousness forms of beings. You know, we're kind of limited right now if we're too afraid of our own shadow to contemplate that if we're going to meet someone, they're not all going to be positive or negative. They're going to be shades of just what we are, shades of people who are nice and people who aren't so nice. And that's just, I think, maybe a little bit too overwhelming for most people to to go into on a regular basis if they want to keep their day job, if you know what I mean.
I think so. But I do sometimes think, particularly in the last year, that maybe we are being prepared for something because, you know, NASA is telling us that, you know, they found a microbial form of life in a lake that actually arsenic is one of the elements of life. And then and nobody knew that. And then, you know, they're finding water in places where before it was thought there was none. And they're looking and saying, oh, well, or the astronomy people in this case are looking and they believe that they're finding planets that could sustain life. And I'm like, God, are we being prepared for something? Because it seems like a little, you know, we're getting a little more and a little more and a little more every day.
Well, now, who is it that does was it Nancy Talbot? Is she the one who does some of this plant research in crop circle stuff? I saw her on your list.
Yes. As a matter of fact, Nancy and I are good friends.
Okay. Well, she'd be one that I would be interested in finding out more about because she does the research on the I guess the bio. What is
right?
It? The bio.
She does.
Response.
Yeah, because like in the pods that are blown out, you know, they're not broken. It's like they've been steamed, and the pods have blown out in the sections of the plant where each section comes together. She's mm-hmm. done a lot of amazing research, and she can tell the difference, you know, when one is man-made and when one is not. And she's done her website is just very, very interesting.
Well, I like that. And the reason I tie that in is because there's a piece of tangible proof, a tangible, you know, a physical connection that we can say there is something here that is different and we can't explain it. It isn't something that we know that somebody has gone out and done, especially on this wide scale. And that's in reference to the crop circles and stuff. Some are, in my opinion, are hoaxes, but I think there are a lot more that aren't. And her research is a part of that whole element. And I think the more things that we're able to tie together that have that type of research behind them, that they add that credibility to this whole area that we are desperately needing to tie together right now. And then it becomes a matter of, it doesn't matter if there's a disclosure, there's an awareness and there's enough information to say, this exists. And eventually they'll get around to doing something at a military level, that says we are trying to manage this, but until they get their ducks in a row, I don't blame them for saying we don't document it and crossing their fingers behind their back and saying publicly.
Well, you know what Leslie Kane would like to see, and it's in her book, Pilots.
UFOs.
Oh, gosh.
On the record.
Yeah, on the record. Mm-hmm. She would like to see a government office, even if it's a small one, opened up, you know, to look into these things and investigate these things, but not like Project Blue Book was. But, you know, and she's working behind the scenes to try to make that happen. And I think that would be a positive way to go, you know, if they would do that. At least then people would have one central place to report to. Right now, people don't even know who to report to. MUFON, you know, is the largest organization that is a boots on the ground sort of investigation entity. But still, a lot of people don't really know about MUFON. So policemen and other law enforcement, they don't really investigate it. I know there were some reports of some sightings that people were calling 911 here after the mass sighting, and the 911 operators weren't even writing it down. So,
like, oh yeah, one of those. Okay, clear. Uh huh. Yeah, thank
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly. And I don't know. I hope that she's successful, and I've told her I will do anything I can to help to get that done. But until there's a central place where everybody reports and really serious investigation and funding, you know, that's the problem. Like, I would like to go and check out some of these things, but I don't have funding to do that. So
I know. Yeah, same thing. That's okay. It's happening and it will come. It's just a matter of enough people collaborating and getting together and saying, all right, this is our goal and this is our function and we are it. And maybe that's what it's going to have to take.
Maybe it will.
So are you volunteering?
I would.
Okay. You be president. I'll be secretary. Right out here on the limb. So that's one of the things, though, I think that people are getting a lot more awareness about the lack of any kind of framework. If you have a sighting, who do you call? And a lot of people don't know about MUFON. When they call the police, it's like, yeah, exactly what you described. It's like, hello, this wasn't in my manual. I did hear that the fire department has some kind of a book that, like, page 11. I don't remember anyway. It was there are some obscure little policies that are written into some organizations, but there is no unified, you know, grand scale plan of how to act or how to respond if somebody makes a sighting. We're going to have to break. I want to give you a chance to talk about your appearance coming up. And you said you had two of them. And the book, that's, it's UFOs. And I happen to have one. I did an interview with her earlier. She's another person I really have respect for. And just like you, has had she had family support her while she was tracking this and documenting this for 10 years. So when we accept this call, it isn't a day job. It's called, you know, a wonderful, fabulous hobby. And you really feel compelled to do something because we're not going to get anywhere if we do nothing. And some of us have actual, you know, contacts that we can at least pass the word on to somebody who might be able to take action. What is your event? Again, in Texas, it's the Symposium for Women.
Yes, that one is May 18th, 19th, and 20th in Glen Rose, Texas. You can go to starworksusa.com to read more about it and to register. And then March the 3rd, I will be in San Antonio with Travis Walton speaking for Texas MUFON.
Okay, and Travis Walton, you told about him again. He's the one that made the movie On Fire in the Sky.
That's right.
Okay. And he sounds like a real dynamic speaker. In the 70s, I didn't realize it had been that long ago.
Yes, I know it does. Time flies, doesn't it?
Well, and anyway, I appreciate your time. And I do hope we can work together on something in the future. I hope I'll be able to make it to the conference. I'd love to meet you in person and compare notes. I think we're at this point, especially 2012, we're exploring a whole new area for a lot of us. And my own metaphysical experiences really give me a unique view.
Well, I hope you make it to the conference also, because I would love to meet you in person.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, just do what you're doing, because you add a wonderful note of credibility and authenticity to this. And you're obviously in the right place at the right time, in my opinion, and you're not done yet.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Angela Joyner, you can check out her website and find out, and just check out some of the shows she's done. She's got some great contacts there, angelajoyner.com. And you can check me out again. It's talkingtonightlights.com, or I'm on Facebook. But thank you for your time. And remember, wherever you are, think the best thoughts. Somebody's listening. See ya.
My sport is football, but my passion is education. My name is Nnamdi Asamoah, and this is how I live United. I see too many kids miss out on moving up. Kids who could go on to college, but just need that extra little push. So every year, I take promising high school students on a college tour. We check out the dorms, the library, meet some professors, find out where the best late night grub stops are. It shows them that there's a whole world beyond their own. But what's even better is that most of these kids decide college is for them. I'm Nnamdi Asamoah. I show kids that a higher education means a brighter future. So when it comes to living United, I don't just wear the shirt. I live it. Join me.
It takes all of us working together to make a difference. Find out how you can live United for Education. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.